Back in 1954, the great Aldous Huxley wrote a book called The Doors of Perception. It was a book describing his experiences with mescaline, a journey of sorts into inner space. What if the answers to all of those fundamental mysteries and questions that we explore on this program, UFOs, flying saucers, ETs, aliens, abductions, crop circles, interventions in human affairs by non-human entities or intelligences. What if the answers to all of those mysteries do not lie in outer space, as many of us have expected or predicted over the years, but rather in inner space, in our minds? And what if we could access other worlds, other realities, through the use of psychoactive plants? If it's using magic mushrooms or LSD represents more than just twisting your brain or frying it with chemicals. What if all of that is true, and that in fact maybe some other kind of intelligence left these plants, left these substances here, hoping that humans would one day discover them, figure out how to master them, and use them as a vehicle for making communication? Those are some of the questions, some of the areas explored by the brothers McKenna, Terrence McKenna and his brother Dennis McKenna, who I've tried to get onto the program for a long time. Tonight, it happens to talk about his new book, The Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss. We take our break now, come back with Dr. Dennis McKenna. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Dennis McKenna is an ethnopharmacologist who has studied plant hallucinogens for more than 40 years. In 1975, he co-authored a book, The Invisible Landscape, with his brother Terrence McKenna. The book was based on their investigations of Amazonian hallucinogens back in the early 70s. He also was sort of the co-star of his brother's later book, True Hallucinations, which further described their experiences while in the Amazon. Dennis earned a master's degree in botany at the University of Hawaii and then a doctorate in botanical sciences from the University of British Columbia. And since that time, he's conducted extensive ethnobotanical fieldwork in Peru, Colombia, Brazil, all over the Amazon, currently and on the faculty of the University of Minnesota, and author of a fascinating new book called The Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss. My pleasure to welcome Dennis McKenna to the program. Great to have you here.
Great to be here, George. Thank you for coming on, for inviting me. I mean, I've been looking forward to this.
Me too. I tell you, I looked at the picture that's on the front of the book. I love the title. It's a wonderful title. But that picture on the front of the book of you standing there with your brother, it just brought it back memories of my childhood and my brother. And then I got into the discussion of you describing him as both your mentor and your tormentor. Brought back a lot of memories of childhood. And anyone who's had a brother or an older brother can relate to it, I think. It's a wonderful book.
Well, thank you so much. Yes. This book is, it's the work of about 18 months, and I figured that Terrence had told his story and our story for a long time and in several different places, and I thought it was about time that I told my story and, you know, brought my own perspective to it. And so it's a memoir, I guess, in the classical sense, and I started with our childhood, and like all brothers, I guess, or siblings, we had our rivalries, but I loved my brother very much, and he was an amazing person, and I wouldn't be the person I am if I hadn't had the privilege of growing up with him. He was just one of those people that broke the mold, if you know what I mean, and I loved him, he loved me, and it turns out many, many people, identify with our story. That was one of the reasons I wanted to tell it, because we lived through this turbulent era of the 60s and 70s and the psychedelic revolution and the Vietnam War and all this. And I thought it was time to tell the story. And 2012, what better year is there than to let the world in on it? So,
well, the book was amazingly candid. I mean, way more candid than I would ever be in a memoir, talking about some intimate parts of your life. I applaud your courage. And I also
Well,
applaud you for.
I got some flack for that, but I figured if you're going to write a memoir, you may as well make it honest, you know. I mean, and with every memoir, there's much that's said and much that's left unsaid. So, you know, with the help of a good editor, I said what I felt we ought to say or, you know, needed to be said. I hope nobody's offended by it, but I hope people do like it and read it, you know.
Well, I get the sense your brother was this big, boisterous, over-the-top character, larger than life, and he cut a wide swath. He took a lot of air out of the room when he would walk in, and you convey that. And I think people who are familiar with his work, they think of you or before with, oh yeah, that's the other guy, that's the brother. But the fact is, what comes across without you tooting your own horn, is that you were the flip side of of the same coin that. While you recognize that your life is better for having been his brother, I think his life is better for having known you. And I don't think he would have done nearly the kind of work he did without you as part of the team.
No, I think that's true. And you know, I think Terrence would be the first one to acknowledge that. You know, he was always, you know, he always went out of his way in his public lectures to acknowledge me. And, you know, we were collaborators. I mean, we were not only brothers, but we were colleagues. And I think we both brought a lot to the table, in the sense that he had this, as you say, very expansive view. He was, you know, extremely widely read and you know, smart as the Dickens, and just had this, you know, amazing wit and ability to just, I mean, I never saw him use a note. I never saw him practice a lecture, but he would just get up there and reel it out. And I'm a different sort of person, but I'm more grounded in the sciences and you know, and so I was a good balance to his metaphysical craziness, if you will. And I
Although,
think we worked
as I
well
read,
together.
you're pretty crazy yourself, though, at times.
Well, yeah, well, you know, it's a crazy field, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't be into this and not be a little twisted. And I think I've, you know, managed to navigate, but you know, it's so interesting to me. You know, we got into all this really in the 60s. You know, we lived through that era. We never really flagged, our interests never really flagged. Other people, you know, in that era, they may have been part of the counterculture. They probably almost always took LSD or some other psychedelic, but then they, you know, eventually moved on and didn't really, you know, and that's fine. I mean, that's what people do. We moved on too, in the sense that we developed careers and we developed directions. But I have to say, you know, that some of the experiences that we had in the 60s, you know, determined our future direction because we just could not ignore it. We just thought that the psychedelic experience, especially the DMT experience, which we might talk about, was one of the most amazing things that we'd ever encountered. Not simply the most amazing drug, but one of the most amazing phenomena. And we couldn't say, well, that's interesting. Now let's go back and, you know, do our courses in cost accounting or whatever. We just said, this is worth investigating. This is truly a mystery. And, you know, that's what pulled us forward. That's what has been the continuing carrot for us for all of our lives, was an attempt to understand the phenomenon of the psychedelic experience. And but you know, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. It relates to everything. It relates to the issue of consciousness. What is consciousness? What might the influence of these plants have been on our consciousness and the evolution of, you know, on the appearance or evolution of consciousness in our species? You know, what is the planetary significance of these plants, if anything, and you know, the archaic institutions of shamanism? You know, what does it all mean? I mean, you can't take psychedelics and not wonder, what does it all mean? And does it mean anything? I think that's what motivates people to do it and keeps them engaged. Everyone is looking for meaning something meaningful in their life, whatever, whether it be religion or their work or, you know, various things. For us, psychedelics was a continuing carrot. It led our imagination into, you know, as you read the book, some very strange highways and byways of the human mind.
Let's jump into the deep end of the pool. I wanted to sort of lob you a big fat softball to capsulize for me and characterize your brother's work, what his lasting legacy was. Maybe this is a way to do it, though. 2012. Here we are. We're a few days away from December 2012. Lots of apocalyptic predictions about that, the end of the Mayan calendar. Some right. people thinking the Earth is going to blow up, that an asteroid's going to get us, that God will smite us down and turn the planet into a cinder, or others predicting a cosmic mind shift, a new age of Aquarius. Your brother is one of the first guys to start writing about something really big coming in December 2012. You took a very different view, and maybe that's a way to get into the larger discussion, is how he arrived at his conclusion, how you arrived at yours.
Right. Well, you're not kidding when you say we're jumping into the deep end of the pool here.
We'll backtrack. Yeah. I promise we'll backtrack.
Yeah. Well, inevitably, you know, 2012 is on everybody's mind because, as you say, it's, you know, we're less than a month now from the posited end date. You know, I mean, this is, we could spend the whole evening talking about this. As a scientist, I say you have to be skeptical, you know. I mean, that's what scientists are. They always hedge their bets. And people say, well, is something apocalyptic or transformational or, you know, catastrophic? Is that going to happen on December 21st, 2012? I doubt it. But does that mean that December 21st, 2012 does not mark an important date? You know, it certainly does in the Mayan calendar, in lots of traditions, you know, not only the Mayans. And of course, my brother's time wave theory was based on the I Ching. So that's another angle. Does it mean the world's going to end? Well, you know, I hope not. I mean, and I don't think so. I don't believe it's going to work that way. I am more inclined toward the idea that it might be a transformational pivot point in a certain sense. But if you look around you, that's already happening. I mean, Terrence and I had a different view of this idea of novelty and how novelty enters or asserts itself into reality. And he had a notion that novelty is something that happens abruptly, like the, you know, like an asteroid impact or the explosion of the atomic bomb or some event that's really new under the sun that never actually happened and that in some way changed everything. I agree that novelty changes reality over time, but I think it's more of a slow process. I mean, was the explosion of the atomic bomb over Hiroshima the really novel event, or was it when Einstein, you know, sat in his office and thought up the equations that, you know, described the process of nuclear fission? And, you know, that was a very quiet thing, but that was the truly novel discovery. Nobody knew it for 50 years. So it's a question of how does novelty express itself? And then with respect to 2012, you know, there are definite astronomical events that are locked into celestial mechanics. There's no doubt about that. All of the, you know, the conjunction of the ecliptic with the galactic center, the solstice point with the galactic center and all that. These are unusual. These are definite important, I guess what you'd call astronomical alignments, astronomical events on the cosmic scale. Does it affect what's going on down here? Well, some would say so. You know, we are part of the universe and maybe we're influenced. And, you know, I mean, my take on the, on 2012, since it's so close, my basic stance is wait and see. You know, we'll know in a few weeks whether, you know, what of the predictions were not true. We'll at least know what predictions weren't true. And, you know, it's not going to be an asteroid. It's not going to be any of these things. If it were going to be an asteroid, we'd already know it, right? Because we would know the asteroid. We would have been able to detect it. We could see it coming. Not coming, as far as anybody knows, which isn't to say they might not have missed it. But, you know, this is, I think 2012 is as much a cultural phenomenon and a collective phenomenon as it is a physical or an astronomical phenomenon. I mean, the fact that there is so much expectation and this sort of wave of, of in some ways hysteria, or in other cases, optimistic expectation, or in other cases, we live in our culture constantly with the idea of apocalypse and the idea of the end of time. And we always think that we're living on the very edge of history, and we are. But what you have to remember is, so is every other civilization that existed. They all existed. They all thought that they were living on the edge of history, and they were right, in a certain sense. So I don't know how you wrap this up and put it into a capsule and say, because the bottom line is, I don't know, and nobody knows.
And that includes your brother.
Those that tell you that they know are kidding themselves, and they're certainly kidding you. People have to sort of trust themselves on this, what their intuition is.
I'm amazed at how many people get angry when you argue with them that the world is not going to end. What do you mean the world's not going to end? Of course it's going to end. I don't know that they want it to be end to prove that they're right. Hey, that means you're dead.
Well, yeah, if it ends that way, although maybe we'll all, collectively ascend to some higher etheric plane. I mean, there are all kinds of scenarios, and Terrence, Terrence loved to speculate about what the end might look like. I don't know if you looked at any of the archival material, but he was saying, it could be an asteroid. It could be the aliens come. It could be, Jesus comes in his silver chariot or golden chariot to smite the wicked and uplift the righteous. These scenarios have always been anticipated in history. They've rarely happened, right? In fact, they've never happened. And sort of my stance is, they ain't gonna happen, most likely. I mean, as a culture, we have a tendency to, we want somebody to, we want a deus ex machina. We have historically and culturally, especially our civilization, we have a sense that the planet's in crisis, and it is in crisis. We want some entity, some event to come and pull our keisters, I guess I can use that word on the radio. We want somebody to pull our keisters out of the fire. We want someone to fix it for us, And I think one of the big lessons that we're learning from 2012 is, Jesus isn't going to come do it. The benevolent alien brothers in their spaceships aren't going to come do it. It's up to us to turn it around. It's up to us to change the planet, to change ourselves, to develop, ways that we can live on this planet in a sustainable way. And so I'm kind of inclining more toward the, it's a transformation of consciousness. It's a change in thinking that has to happen. And I think maybe 2012 is not the end. 2012 is the beginning, if you know what I mean.
Well, I think I do, and I hope you're right.
Yeah, I hope so, too. But in a few weeks, we'll know. And if we're not here, then, then the people that say, well, of course, the world is going to end, they can take a sort of, a grim satisfaction, if you will, in the fact that we'll see we told you so. I don't think they're going to be the ones that are saying, we told you so. I just don't think it's going to happen. I mean,
Dennis McKenna, I'm going to stop you there. The music telling us we're going into a break. My guest is Dr. Dennis McKenna, author of the new book, The Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss, My Life with Terrence McKenna. We'll talk about how he arrived at that title, where that expression came from, and a lot more to come. Dennis McKenna, in the book, you say that the decision to anoint this thing known as the Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss was made in, I think, a Vancouver hotel room. What? How did you arrive at this title, and what does it mean?
Well, yeah, catchy title, right?
Yeah, it's a great title.
Well, it was kind of tongue-in-cheek, you know, in the sense that when we got this idea to go to South America, you know, in search of these exotic hallucinogens and you know, an orally active form of DMT was the holy grail of the time. But we, you know, we're Irish and we have a sense of humor, and I think it's good in dealing with these serious subjects to keep a perspective, and humor helps. So we called ourselves the Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss in jest, kind of, that, you know, it was really a jest. But the origin of the idea kind of goes back to H.P. Lovecraft. As I said in the book, Terrence and I were steeped in science fiction and all this weirdness back in the 60s, Fate magazine. If Coast to Coast AM had existed back then, we'd have been all over it, you know, because of the range of topics that it covers. So, you know, and among those was H.P. Lovecraft, who many of your listeners may know was a science fiction horror writer of the 20s. And he was always talking about, you know, he was different than Poe or these other horror writers of the time who talked about more or less, you know, the undead, ghosts and witches and goblins and that kind of thing. Lovecraft wrote about the horror that comes from beyond the stars, or the horror that comes from ancient past. And so he was always talking about, you know, gibbering abysses of unspeakable horror. And that was kind of our mindset. So when we were sitting around in that Vancouver hotel room speculating about our adventure, we said, you know, we said, yeah, we're the Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss. And not just Terrence and me, but the people that that were lucky enough or unlucky enough to sign on for our little trek to South America. But that was the origin of the thing, basically.
I was, you know, anticipating reading the book and thinking to myself, okay, it's going to chronicle your life with your brother, as implied in the subtitle. And there's going to be a lot of biographical information about growing up, and I'll read that stuff, but I really want to get to the good stuff, which is, you know, your adventures in the Amazon and what you saw and what you experienced. And the reality is, I was just as interested in you guys growing up and your early life, because it was so important to where you ended up. The journey as important as the destination, maybe more so. What is it, do you think, about your upbringing, the lives of your long-suffering parents and the things that you put them through and each other through, that led you to where you ended up?
Well, you know, I've wondered about that myself. I mean, we grew up in this little town in western Colorado, Paonia, Colorado, that is just about as obscure as it can be and just about as normal, whatever that means, as it can be. You know, it's a coal mining, fruit growing town, very conservative. You know, the high school football team is the center of attention. And we were, you know, extra environmentals to that, in McLuhan's term. I mean, we were partly, you know, we were just alienated from that. And I don't know why. I mean, our parents were not particularly odd, although my dad was odder than he would admit to. He was very much invested in being the average guy. He was always talking about how the average guy, and he identified with that idea. But we used to argue about it because he wasn't average, and, you know, he really wasn't average. I mean, he was a pilot. He was widely read. He was not like his friends that he was going golfing with or hanging out, you know, down at the local cafe having coffee with every Saturday. He was much more intellectual than them, and he was interested in ideas, and he would bring home, you know, Fate magazine, as I mentioned, or sometimes science fiction magazines, or, you know, Scientific American, popular science, these kinds of things. He had a real interest in science and technology and space and all of that, and that rubbed off on us, and that got us. I think that was a major influence. I mean, I credit him, although he might say, well, maybe if I was, had been more normal, they wouldn't have gotten into all this. And that's probably true, but I credit him for that. He is what introduced us to a world of ideas and imagination, and we were bookishly inclined, and we were very enthusiastic about space exploration and technology, and by extension, aliens. And so I guess it was just the bubble that we were in, the intellectual bubble in this town, where most people were not interested in that stuff. They were interested in, who was going to be the homecoming queen and what the outcome of the next football game would be. That didn't particularly tweak our buttons, and so, I mean, and Paonia is an interesting town. I mean, some of the strangest and most interesting people I've ever known in my life, and that's still true, that's saying something, have come from Paonia. And we used to say, there's something in the water. I don't know. It
Well,
just turns out odd people.
I give your parents a lot of credit. I mean, you did put them through some trials, but they were seemed in from the book to be very supportive in terms of books and science. They liked the idea of the collections, collecting rocks and bugs and things of that sort. It seemed like they were pretty supportive in that regard.
They were, in fact, that was another thing that made them, so sort of unusual. I mean, they were generally very supportive of that, especially of Terrence. And Terrence was 4 years old, right? Older than I am. So he took the lead, and he was such a brilliant guy that he had many interests. Things came up, and my parents really went out of their way to encourage things, whatever he was interested in, rock collecting, butterfly collecting, model rocketry, making projects for the science fair, and this kind of stuff. They really went out of their way to accommodate him. I mean, and maybe too much. I mean, I was sometimes jealous. I was like, how come he gets all the attention, but at the same time, I wanted in on it. The age gap between us was 4 years. Excuse me, I'm burping. The age gap was 4 years, and that's just wide enough. Had we been closer, things might have been different, but it's just wide enough that Terrence, in some ways, was not only, I mean, he was a brother, but he was also really somebody to look up to. And because he was so, flamboyant and so curious, and I mean, he took the lead, as you said before, he sucked the air out of the room, and that's been true since childhood. Just attention goes to him. Everybody wants to, get involved, because whatever he's doing, it's the coolest thing. And I was that way, and sometimes he'd let me, and I mean, when I was younger, it was like I was just the pesky little brother, like little brothers tend to be. But as we got older, again, our relationship evolved, and we became more like colleagues and fellow explorers. And I do credit him. I mean, he's the one that discovered many of the strange ideas that later we explored together, because he left Paonia early. He left Paonia and finished high school in California, and that was the result of a years-long campaign to get out of there, to get the hell out of Paonia. He hated Paonia, and finally just wore my parents down. And like everything else, they tried to give him what he wanted. He would not be denied, and he was very persistent about that. So they let him go. And so then he was in California, and I was back in Paonia, and we were, I mean, I was almost like an only child. I was an only child at that time, but here I have this incredible brother on the West Coast who's, at the cutting edge of everything going on, socially, culturally, politically. And he would come back at Christmas and during the summers and share all this with me. I mean, it was like, it couldn't have been more wonderful than if he'd been an explorer on the other side of the world, bringing all this news back, and that's how it was. And we really bonded more after he left home than when we were living together at home, you know, and that's really when our relationship sort of matured into a collegial kind of relationship rather than a big brother, little brother, you know, kind of dynamic.
Well, he might as well have been in another universe because he ended up in Berkeley. You were in Berkeley for a while.
Exactly.
I know I lived in Berkeley a few years
there
after
you
did. I missed the most tumultuous time, but it was still a place of many distractions and oddities. And it was the center of a very strange universe at that time. I want to use that as a way to sort of explore the whole concept of altered states. Talk to me about human interest in achieving an altered state, whether it's the first humans who sampled fermented fruit and got a buzz on, the interest in just getting hammered. I mean, you and your brother as kids did what most kids or a lot of kids did in that time period. You tried this and then it led to that and on and on. But I mean, what is it about altered states that humans are seeking? Is there something more than just getting a buzz on?
Well, it is. I think it's more than getting a buzz on. I mean, it may start out that way, but I think that altered states, I think that built into our brains and our human nature is an innate desire to push the envelope in a certain ways. I mean, we are conscious beings. We have that distinction. No other animal on Earth is conscious in the way that we are. And so we crave novelty. We like to push the envelope, and people push it through altered states, you know, deliberately achieved. I mean, you can take psychedelics, you can do various, you know, spiritual disciplines like meditation, or, you know, you can go helicopter skiing in the Himalaya, and that's also seeking an altered state. We get bored easily, you know. I think that's part of it, because we are conscious. Our minds are always probing the environment. They're always looking for the edge. Now, not everybody. I mean, some people are quite happy to just play it safe, and they don't really go seeking these things. But I think their lives must be boring, and I think that, you know, people of that mindset don't really change the world much. I mean, they just sort of live and they do what they do. But the people that really make it different are people that seek novel experience, and it's built into this complex brain of ours. You know, we have the receptors to mediate these kinds of experiences, psychedelic experiences or mystical experiences, you know, all of these kind of realms of you know, of subjective experience, and we like to explore. I really think basically that's it. You know, we're just curious about what the boundaries of experience can encompass, if you will, and it's that desire to look beyond, look over the next horizon. Or I love the woodcut of an early conception of the cosmos with many many concentric spheres, and you've got the pilgrim who's crawled to the edge of the cosmos and stuck his head through. I'm sure you all know. I can't give you the, you know that image. That's what people do. We like to look behind the circuitry. We like to know what's going on over the next horizon, or, you know, in the next universe, if you will. That's what the motivation is. And, you know, if we weren't creatures like that, you know, we'd still be living in trees and we wouldn't be human. We wouldn't. I mean, I think really that is what makes us human, is the fact that we push through. And, you know, so it just seems to be something that's built into our neural circuitry in a way. And, oh, yeah, what I wanted to say, too, is this is the passion that drives science, right? I mean, science in its best embodiment, in its truest form, is driven by curiosity. You know, science in its truest form is a search for truth and a attempt to satisfy curiosity. If it weren't for that, most scientists would not be in the business, you know, or many scientists, because it's not a particularly well compensated profession. It has a lot of frustrations, especially these days. But many scientists, the best scientists that I've ever met in my life, are motivated by this passion to understand and curiosity, in a word. Well, it's a dangerous thing, but it's also what got us here. And you don't satisfy curiosity without taking risks, right? But it's worth it because look where we are.
There's a phrase I use I've used in discussing UFOs, but it applies to a much broader sense, is that it's the duty of science and journalism to investigate the unexplained, not to explain the uninvestigated. And sadly, your description of this passion that drives science in its truest form is not true for so much of science, and I'm sure there's few people in the world know this better than you. I can only imagine the kind of crap you've got for your willingness to go down this path to explore whether or not hallucinogens can teach us something about, quote, the real world.
Well, yes, that's quite right. I mean, science is exactly, science is an institution now, and it's frustrating. This kind of science I was talking about is kind of the ideal, the science as it should be. Well, now science is, big business and big technology, and there's a lot of money involved, and it's very institutionalized. It's kind of like what happened to religion, some centuries ago. Religion at the time, in the before, for example, the church got highly established, was a pretty edgy thing itself. It was based on direct mystical experiences, and then the institution evolved to suppress that. That was too dangerous. I think you're seeing much the same thing has taken place in science. Science becomes this conservative, rigidified institution, and it's no longer about seeking truth, which is what it ought to be. That really is what it ought to be, because it's the most powerful tool that we have yet developed to seek truth, to uncover truth. But, many scientists never think about that. They think science is about getting grants and having graduate students and going to conferences and publishing papers and doing all these things that you do as a scientist. And this is all very well, right? This is good. This is the sign of a productive scientist. But if you're not ultimately seeking truth, you're wasting your time,
Well, we're
in
going to
my opinion.
explore your journey to seek out truth and some of the strange places it's taken you and your brother right after this.